What's up, Internet? Welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm senior editor Devinder Hardawarth. This week I'm joined by Sam Rutherford, senior writer. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how's it going?
Going okay. And also podcast producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. We're back. We're back on a live stream. We're back with a full show, too. If you missed last week's episode, I did an interview with Carvana's CPO. That's worth checking out if you hate the car buying experience. We're going to talk about the state of games and kind of where the industry is right now. This is going to be one of many discussions, but this is triggered from the news that EA plans to be going private in 2027. They're selling to a whole bunch of folks that are kind of like iffy and messy, but it's a $55 billion acquisition. That's going to have long-term reactions for the game industry. But also, there's a whole bunch of news from Microsoft and Xbox. There's stuff happening all around the games. There's also a bunch of games that are out now that we want to talk about that we're enjoying. So we want to
really good games.
Really good games. Games I cannot stop playing, including Silksong, of course, but also Final Fantasy Tactics. I really want to talk about my love for that game. So we've also got some chat about the Amazon event, all the new Echo stuff, and a bit of news, too. If you've been enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes, drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com, and definitely leave us your questions because they may get used in the Ask Engadget section on the site, may become a whole post. So, you know, drop us your notes, podcast@engadget.com. Join us Thursday mornings around 10:30 a.m. Eastern for our live streams. You can watch us show off gadgets. We'll do some Q&A, and we've got a fun crowd in the chat room, too. So join us. It's a blast. I want to start this week off by just talking about this EA acquisition, because it's wild. It is $55 billion. It is taking a company that's been public for decades, a well-known gaming company. It's going to be sold to a bunch of investors, including the Saudi Arabia Public Investment Fund, the PIF, Silver Lake, and Affinity Partners. Affinity Partners, by the way, which is, I believe, co-run, or at least in conjunction with Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. So all our favorite people are going to be buying EA. And this brings up a lot of questions, too, because the Saudi Arabian investment thing, everyone's talking about the Riyadh Comedy Festival that's happening right now, too, and the sort of blowback comedians are getting for that. In short, it is a comedy festival taking place in Riyadh by the Saudi Arabian government. They're paying these comedians to go there. Saudi Arabia, country known for many problems, sort of chopping up journalists that they don't like, imprisoning people who criticize the government, using slave labor to
Jamal
build out
Khashoggi
their...
is not the only one.
Yeah,
too.
He's not the only one. He's the one we know about, and it's been confirmed, and it's disgusting, and the guy behind all that, the Crown Prince, is also the one pushing all this entertainment stuff, because the country needs things beyond oil. They need investments beyond oil. They need to make money, and also sort of like sanitize the sort of scary image they've had from doing all this stuff. So this is what all of this stuff is part of. I've seen some thinking here that, you know, the EA acquisition could be good for them because for things like yearly or annual releases for sports games, investment funds tend to like that. They may not be investing like big, crazy ideas. It also, by going private, the thing that we do every quarter is where we look at a company's quarterly earnings and kind of see how they're doing. They're not beholden to investors. They don't have to deal with quarterly earnings. There is some thinking that private companies can be a little braver and bolder in terms of the ideas they cover, but I don't know if that's necessarily going to be the case here.
So before we get deeper into the ramifications, let's talk about just where this sits in the general scope of leverage buyouts. This is now the biggest leverage buyout in history.
And what do you mean by leverage buyout? Specifically, that is...
Leverage buyout is where a bunch of like private equity companies get together and they're like, hey, we want to buy this, but also in order to buy this, we're going to borrow money. The private equity firms are not going to borrow the money. The company borrows the money to buy itself. So this deal was $36 billion from all of the partners, the Saudi Investment Fund, Kushner's company, and the like. And $20 billion is going to go in on EA's balance sheet as debt.
Yeah, so a bank, I think it's JP Morgan, but a bank is putting in that money too. So
yes,
it's weird how all this stuff works. Yeah.
Yeah, this is the biggest leveraged buyout in history now. Second is a Texas electric company called Energy Future Holdings.
Uh-huh.
And the third is Elon Musk's Twitter buyout. Because that was 40-something billion in 2022. Now I think we're more set up to talk about why there might be so many layoffs, because it's not just like things are redundant or like these private equity firms are just going to want to make things as efficient as possible, big air quotes there. It's that EA now has $20 billion of new debt on its balance sheet that they're going to say like, oh no, how can we possibly make money on Madden? And like, it's EA FC now. Yeah. It's not even FIFA because their deal with FIFA ran out. How can we possibly make money if we don't do major layoffs?
I don't quite know. Like, I'm not a finance guy. I don't know how, if you're the one borrowing the money, how does this become part of your purchase like value? I don't understand that, especially when it's a debt that you will have to deal with once the acquisition goes through. By the way, this is all pending regulatory approval. I think they're thinking that this, they'll aim to get it completed by 2027, early 2027. If it doesn't go through, there was $1 billion cancellation fee, which is very typical for these things. But here's the thing. The reason we're seeing this and so many other companies be like, now is a good time to start merging and acquiring things, is because of lax regulations from the Trump administration. Also, literally, this is a major investment from his son-in-law's investment fund. It's probably going to go through. It's probably going to go through without much issue. Yeah.
Notice that the Trump kids are also factoring into the goings-on in Washington much less in this go-round of the Trump administration. So I think they're just trying to like move in silence and make a bunch of money.
Move in silence, make put up, what was it? Instagram photos of your shirts from on the White House and try to sell that too, which is what his granddaughter was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shirts made in Bangladesh, everybody. All that fun stuff. So it is also worth pointing out, this is not the overall biggest acquisition in the gaming world. I think that one is still Microsoft buying Activision Blizzard, which was $75.4 billion. That's how insane that deal was. Microsoft was just like, oh yeah, we're gonna buy it. We're not gonna bring in all these other investors. We're not gonna pile on debt. I forget if that was like a stock deal or something, but they had the money to certainly buy that. All this is to say, EA is no longer going to be the EA. If this goes through, EA that you knew and maybe loved, I don't know, will not exist moving forward. It's going to be a very different thing run by very different overlords. This is also part of the whole issue we've seen around consolidation in the gaming world too, in a certain sense. Like EA was always its own thing, but now it's going to be owned by different people and they're going to have different priorities too. So with Activision Blizzard, we certainly saw a lot of layoffs at those studios, a lot of games being canceled, and also a lot of messiness too. Like just Microsoft was not paying attention to those studios or those developers, and games just kind of came out and were not as optimized or were not as polished as they should have been if they were owned by a company that actually paid attention to them. So there's all sorts of things that can happen. We don't really have much other news to go on right now other than to say this is wild and you may want to pour one out for EA in the coming year because it's going to be a very, very different company moving forward.
So let me ask you, when you say pour one out, like, do you think people are going to be sad about this? I understand that
a lot of
like
people won't notice. Yeah.
There are some like, you know, big franchises that EA is in charge of. I think probably Battlefield is probably the biggest one.
Yeah. Need for Speed and all that stuff. Yeah.
But so it's like, you know, coming from like a longtime gamer, it's like if you look at the history of like EA acquisitions and the number of studios and franchises that EA has run to the ground, in a lot of ways, this is like kind of karma coming full cycle where, you know, now private equity has kind of bought them out and they're getting saddled with their own debt, pretty much.
I hear you, Sam. It's not quite karma because all the people at the top will be seriously rewarded for this deal. And the shareholders will make a lot of money as part of this deal, too. So they're not being punished. They're being rewarded, if anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the developers were the ones who were like, I can't wait to cancel this title.
For sure. I just feel very conflicted about this because it's like EA has run some of like my favorite gaming franchises into the ground.
Absolutely.
Like Command & Conquer. I'm not a Sims player, but they have not really done a lot with the Sims in a way that I think people would really like to see. Star Wars Battlefront, Skate, Plants for Zombies. Remember when they took Plants for Zombies, a really fun tower defense game, and tried to make it a first-person shooter? Yeah, how'd that work out?
You know, as any big, especially a big video game company, like they were messy. Like they ruined a lot of things too, and a lot of people are saying like good riddance here. I'm saying like we should think about it more broadly. Like it would have been nice if somebody were able to come in and kind of right the ship, maybe.
For sure. This is the responsible, let's try to be better, like, you know,
but that's what they
take.
Always say. That's what private equity says. They're like, oh, well, there were excesses from being a public company. It was running inefficiently. We can come in and right the ship. And their idea of righting the ship is laying off a bunch of people, cutting benefits, making things overall worse for workers. So if you were ever a proponent of that one post, I think it was probably from Twitter, back when it was Twitter, that I want game devs to get paid more to work less and shorter games with worse graphics, that's going to be impossible under this new regime at EA.
Basically. And this is also sort of like the inevitable outcome of any major company that finds a certain amount of success. If you are a public company, your investors are just pushing you to grow, push that stock price up, make as much revenue, cut costs where you can.
Right. That's the traditional trap of like a public company. You are always looking 4 months ahead to that next quarterly earnings report to make the shareholders happy.
Although it really depends on whether or not there's going to be quarterly earnings reports too. If you've heard what the Trump administration says they want to do, they want like bi-yearly earnings or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's weird. Sam, you were talking about Command & Conquer. In the last like week or so, I was seeing more people post that one clip of Tim Curry saying that he's escaping to the one place that,
God bless him,
hasn't been corrupted by capitalism. I didn't really realize that the EA purchase was probably spurring people remembering, like, remember what EA did to Command & Conquer?
Yeah, yeah, all that stuff. The guy who did the "it's in the game" voice, there are TikToks of him going around because he's now an older gentleman. He's like showing his kids, this is how you do it. EA Sports is in the game. I never even played EA Sports games, but like that was a thing that was so iconic in the 90s. EA was not a great company, but it's not going to this will not fix any of the problems of EA. It will certainly only worsen the problems that the game industry is facing right now. And we can only wait and see like where this goes. Like this will most likely go ahead. There's kind of nothing stopping them because what all these big companies are getting from this current administration is just a lack of roadblocks and a green light to do whatever they want, so long as they kiss the ring. Kind of related to all this, don't forget that Pokemon Go is also now owned by a Saudi company because they bought the video game side of Niantic a couple of years ago for $3.5 billion. So they definitely, the Saudi government also wants to be in charge of more entertainment and to be making money there, but also to be like, hey, we're the ones giving you the things you love, right?
Right. And it's not just good. Like the comedy, you know, festival that's going on. They've had like WWE events hosted in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And so this is definitely part of a bigger push from Saudi. You know, the LIV Golf thing, I believe, was tied to the Saudis as well. And so
they've backed up dump trucks full of money onto like the top 10 soccer players. Front lawns.
For sure. Yep. And so this is definitely like a big push by the Saudi government as a whole to kind of, hey, we want to change our image by bringing in more of these, you know, outside entertainment vehicles.
Absolutely. So, yeah, go ahead.
And like, who knows how effective it's going to be? This stuff is mostly targeting like people who I think are older and might already have some set ideas about Saudi Arabia.
I actually think it's the opposite. I actually think the Saudis are going after the younger generation who don't have memories of, before having previous interactions. And so they're going to grow up, you know, they take like a 12-year-old kid who watches WWE. They're going to grow up thinking that Saudi Arabia is like this big entertainment hub. And so they won't have that like the same kind
something
of context
like a
that,
Dubai
older
or a Monaco
might.
Or
sure.
something, right?
But I also a lot of countries that have done bad things are looking like, man, everybody really loves Japan now, huh? Everybody loves Japan. Let's all forget about what happened a while ago during World War II. Let's forget about all that because We love
Let's
anime.
Let's forget about the entire reason we understand how Frostbite works.
Yeah.
Japanese Unit 731, go look it up.
Yep, that's all fun stuff. So, hey, yeah, a lot of countries have done many things, and the U.S. as well. The U.S. is not innocent in many things, but countries will also do many things to sort of like make themselves look better in the eyes of history, and I kind of feel like that's what's happening here. Certainly not to the same degree, but I also wanted to talk about what the hell is happening with Microsoft and Xbox, because it just seems like fail after fail after fail over here. This week they announced that Game Pass Ultimate is moving to $30 a month, up from, what, 20, right? They are making some features better. They are making the game streaming better. The cloud streaming is actually finally going up to 1440p. It's going to be a little faster. The queues should be faster. They're also bringing cloud streaming down to the lower tier. So there is a $10 Game Pass tier and the $15 tier. Those differ in, like, do you get the first run games or not? They kind of differ in terms of features. But they are trying to spread that out a bit. Still, Game Pass Ultimate, $30. That's the one a lot of people want, because that also lets you play Game Pass stuff on your PC and on your console. It's kind of like a just a free-for-all for you to get whatever you want from Microsoft. But they also raised prices of Xbox consoles last month. And it's wild, like, where things sit now. The Xbox
Series
S.
That was the second price increase.
That was the second price increase. And the Xbox Series S is now $400. The Series X Digital is $600. The Series S was supposed to be the cheap one, right? That thing was getting close to $200 on sale over the past few years before certain things happened. The economy took a tank. Series X Digital is $600. Series X 2TB Galaxy Special Edition is $800, which is more than the PlayStation 5 Pro, which is a new console that can actually do more things than the Series X. Just kind of a wild situation they're in. Things are so bad right now that we saw the news that Costco has confirmed it is not going to be stocking Xboxes anymore. Because why? Who would buy an Xbox right now?
I mean, that's just a really bad sign. As soon as people are having a harder time finding your product, then you're not getting your product into the hands of customers, which is where you need to be if you want to grow market share, popularity, etc.
Absolutely true. Also, this is kind of an unprecedented thing that's happening, because it's like nobody is going for that hardware. It's not just that Microsoft can't sell the hardware. I think they're aware. That's kind of why this price increases have been happening. It's also partially why they've had that, like, Xbox, everything is an Xbox marketing thing, right? Like, your computer with cloud streaming is an Xbox. This ROG Xbox Ally handheld is an Xbox. Your gaming PC, Xbox too, because you can just do all this stuff to it. So they're kind of like flattening what the idea of an Xbox is. But the console itself, for the love of God, do not buy an Xbox console right now. Certainly don't buy a Series S. Don't buy a Series X. Save that money. If you need a game system under your TV, the PlayStation 5 is the way to go, because also Microsoft is getting their first party game to other platforms. Not Halo yet, but Gears of War, certainly. Call of Duty is technically theirs now. Forza Horizon is all moving over there. So it's like, for this generation, it is wild how you can, like, look at how they failed the launch of the original Xbox One, basically. The Xbox One, which was the follow-up to the 360, they had so much goodwill from the 360, blew it all, because they were like, this is an entertainment device. It has to be online all the time. And people did
not like
that.
I was about to say, is this now two generations of underperforming home entertainment things, not even game consoles from Microsoft?
Absolutely. And here's the thing. The very first Xbox, the big old boxy Xbox from Microsoft,
Duke.
Also total failure. The Duke, well, that was the controller. But it was a total failure, billions of dollars lost. They had to get the hell out of that console and basically ramp up to get the 360 out quicker than people expected. That's part of why Sony was caught flat-footed with the PS3. So the 360 was...
I liked the original Xbox, but then again, I was young enough to not really know better.
The greatest thing about the original Xbox is that it had an Ethernet port. So if you were in a college like I was and that was fully networked... Yeah. You could play Halo with people in other dorm rooms and stuff and have the time of your life, because this was before Xbox Live launched. This was before online matchmaking was even a thing. But yeah, the 360 came in and kind of defined how online matchmaking would work on consoles. It made indie games accessible on consoles, because you could just download them because you have the internet. So that was such a perfect console for the time that fully met the moment. Xbox One did not meet the moment. In fact, completely swung and missed by trying to include the Kinect and trying to include like all of Microsoft's like entertainment marketing stuff. And this gen, everybody was hit by the pandemic. Things were really unstable. But Xbox was just like, oh yeah, we're going to make the most powerful box there is, and that's going to be, we're going to be more powerful than the PlayStation 5. Technically true, developers did not give a shit. So that's kind of like, they're just stuck now. They're stuck because people are not buying this hardware. It's had to get more expensive because of tariffs and because of stuff happening from this administration, and also just the overall economic, like the economy around the world is kind of a mess now too. Where does Microsoft go from
the
here?
Tariffs and all that, that's a huge part of it.
It's a huge part of it. But it also kind of seems like the ROG Xbox Ally devices could be another first step for them. The Xbox Ally is $600. The Xbox Ally X, the more powerful one, is $1,000. And Sam, you are our resident like portable game console guy at this point. What do you think of these? Like, do you think these could actually help Microsoft? Because I think I have a lot of thoughts, but what do you think?
I'm of two minds. I think there's kind of like a question I think that the handheld gamers kind of need to answer as a market. And that's the thing is there's one camp of handheld gamers who love playing like retro stuff, and they just, you know, they need dirt cheap handhelds. And then you look at the Steam Deck, and that's kind of like in the $500, $600 price range for like nicely spec'd ones. You can get them for even cheaper than that.
Like $400 is the base ones, and they often go on sale. Yeah.
Right. And then there's this other camp where it's like, I want big performance out of a handheld. And this has been kind of the push, because part of the reason why that ROG Ally Xbox X is so expensive is because that has the Ryzen Z2 Extreme chip. And this is actually slightly cheaper than the Lenovo Legion Go 2, which is for the same chip. It's starting around $1,100
to $1,300. Insane.
I'm sitting here. It's like, oh man, I appreciate the Steam Deck even more than I did before, because it remains relatively affordable. The performance is not outstanding, but it's good enough for most of the stuff that I need to play. And at the end of the day, this is like an extra machine. This is not going to be your primary. You're not going to buy this to do homework at college on, right? It's like, it's not that type of device. And so, but there is that camp who really want big performance. And unfortunately, when you want big performance, you have to push hardware, you have to push silicon, and that results in a really, really high price tag, which, I mean, yes, the regular ROG Xbox Ally still exists, and that is definitely more affordable, but it's like, what's the limit on this? Like, now we have these PC gaming handhelds that cost more than a console, which was sort of it was supposed to be a portable console that you could take on the go, and now that's not really the case anymore. And so, in some ways, this is good because, hey, we do have more choice. It's not like the other older handhelds are gone. You know, you can still buy them, and a lot of them have been discounted, so they are more affordable than at launch. But I think it'll be a really interesting thing to see where this kind of market develops in terms of how many people want big, basically gaming laptop performance in a handheld, or how many people want something a little bit more portable, a little bit more affordable for playing stuff on the couch. And then, you know, there's that whole can of worms. It's like, hey, has game streaming gotten so good to the point where all you really need is kind of a dummy device with a really good Wi-Fi 5G connection, and then you could just stream everything in the cloud and pay monthly and then have a cheaper, you know, hardware to play your game streaming stuff.
I think these device makers made a fundamental problem when they started focusing on, like, these gamers are demanding high performance, the same crazy gamers who don't mind spending $1,000 plus on a graphics card, right? So, yeah, I can see Lenovo catering to them and Xbox ROG and everybody. That does seem like a mistake, because you're right, Sam. It misses all the good stuff that happened with the Steam Deck, but also what happened with the Switch. And people tend to forget that the Switch basically begat the Steam Deck. Like, the Switch kind of proved a handheld device, even if it's underpowered, can do a lot. And now you have the Switch 2 at $450. You have the Steam Deck, which starts around $400. I've seen sales for refurbed units go for like $350. You can do a lot with the Steam Deck. And that was the idea, that you have a really decent amount of gaming performance in a device under $500. Sure, you could spend more, a little bit more, to get a better screen or whatever. But generally, $500 is kind of where we're hovering around for a device that could give you basic gaming, maybe hook it up to TV, maybe use it as like a mini console. when you get to closer to $1,000, when you get to actually $1,000, it seems like, who the heck is this thing for? Because
right. If you're having to choose between, do I get a new laptop or do I get a new handheld gaming PC? That becomes a very weird question to ask, especially depending on your budget.
And also the graphical differences on a screen that's like 7 to 8 inches, you are not really going to see that much compared to getting a laptop with a bigger screen or playing on a normal PC. Like, you're not going to see a lot of these differences that you're paying for in this hardware. It just seems like a mistake to me. And I also feel like all the ROG Xbox Ally devices are too expensive for what they are. Like, the base one should be $500. It should be closer to that. If you're going to have a more premium one, $800. Because what is, like, $800-ish seems like the upper limit of what that could acceptably be. And now,
and once again, I think tariffs are, you know, impacting this. I think... if you looked at some, internal business documents from Microsoft and Asus, I think they were shooting for $500 and closer to $800, $850. And so a lot of there are some outside influences that are making this even more challenging, especially from the consumer standpoint, than they probably otherwise would have been. But yeah, it's really frustrating to see.
Yeah. So.
The question that I posed to both of you right before we started recording was, does this mean that PlayStation and Sony are at the absolute back of the pack when it comes to handhelds now? Because we were just talking about, like, the Nintendo begat the Steam Deck, and now we have this ROG Ally that's, like, flawed and too expensive, but at least it exists. And PlayStation has the Portal.
They have the Portal, and they're working on one. So that
I don't think so. Yeah, there are reports that they're working one. I don't know, Dev, you kind of like the Portal, and I did not like the Portal.
I did not like the Portal.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, my review was like 75. I like the idea of the Portal
as something that, like, hey, it lets you play your PlayStation games on the couch while someone else is watching TV, turn the volume down. But I don't think that Sony's on the back foot. Number one, because remember, Asus is making the ROG Xbox Ally. This is not a Microsoft thing. Microsoft is putting a little bit of dev work into the software and stuff like that, which, don't get me wrong, is very important. But I think more of the risk is coming from Asus in terms of, stakes and future development. And on top of that, I don't think it's that much more work because the Portal exists. And I think the design of the Portal is not, is interesting and, feasible in a way that you could see, oh, we can kind of translate this into a future device. And so the thing that bums me out the most is that if you go back to the Vita days and the PSP days, the thing that bums me out is Sony had a pathway. They had a product line for all of this, and they let it languish. And that's what bugs me the most. I think if Sony comes out with a new, let's call it the Portal 2 or whatever you want it, and it's got good hardware and it's got a good price, I think any sort of like leapfrogging will instantly be erased. They have very much they are in a position where they can instantly become, a big player again in the handheld space. They just got to pick their spots and decide, hey, we want to do it and we want to do it right. And that is kind of the big question for them.
What a cell phone it was for Sony, by the way, because like the PlayStation Portal was a pretty big success for them. Like that was delivering pretty great hardware back then. The Portable, the original PSP, the PlayStation Vita, that was really good hardware. Like that was an OLED screen, great hardware. And they just like kept failing. They did not get the developer push they needed. And that's on Sony because they did not convince developers to make the games for that system. And then a couple of years later, the Switch launches and kind of like reinvents everything because it's not just a portable system. It's a system that can be a hybrid thing.
And it was so weird that Sony didn't double down on the Vita after the Switch came out and be like, oh, we can do this too. And instead they kind of retreated and go, oh, we're going to take a break from this space entirely. And yeah, that was a very interesting business decision.
I mean, the focus was like
painful for the bean counters to see all these losses. Like they didn't know what they didn't know. They didn't know that handhelds were just on the horizon. So I imagine they were talking about sunsetting the whole handheld division as Nintendo was talking about like ramping everything up. And that's just bad timing.
all these companies know what hardware is available, Ben. Like, all these companies know that NVIDIA has a chip that can be really powerful in a couple of years, and they've been talking about that for a while. But do they choose to bet on that or not? And I think, like, that's the thing. Like, they chose not to bet. And they honestly, Sony doubled down on PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 5, and PlayStation 5 has been a huge success for them. Like, they undoubtedly own this generation because Microsoft stumbled so much. So when you want a high-end console under your TV, that's what you go to. But then Nintendo's out here still selling Switches like hotcakes and now have a more expensive Switch, so they could do that too. And anyway,
someone in the chat brought up a good point. Sorry, I forget who it is. But
I want to bring it up because I asked him how to pronounce his name. So it's Niranjan Banda, who asked, what's the point of gaming on a hardware if everything's cloud streaming and subscription-based now? Do we ever get to own anything and play offline like we used to, like the Steam catalog? And I think that's a great question.
That's certainly true. I think we're going to see a lot of this, by the way, because, like, I've seen the best of game streaming that's out there. And right now that's NVIDIA's GeForce Now, which is fantastic. It's only $20 a month. So if you want a game and you have a screen, you have, like, just a laptop, that thing is good and worth checking out. But also, it's limited because any hiccup you have on internet, if you want to step outside away from a really fast internet connection, you're going to have a bad experience. So sometimes you just want to, like, be somewhere else, not at home, not connected to the internet, and still play a game or something. So
I think even today there is still value in having local hardware where you're not you don't have to ping a server somewhere, or you don't have to rely on a wireless connection to play your games. And, you know, if you care about stuff like latency, even with the best connections, you're still going to have a better time with local hardware, assuming it's affordable and you can carry it around in a meaningful way. But the other thing that someone mentioned is that, is Xbox at a point where they're going to have to do the Sega choice, or they're going to have to give up making physical gaming hardware, and they're going to be like, okay, we are just a publisher now, we make games, and the games go on whatever platform that we can get it on, PC, Nintendo, PlayStation, whatever.
That's kind of the question, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is the big crossroads that Microsoft is at right now, and I think more than likely they are probably going to do the Sega thing, because this actually aligns with what the Xbox team has been saying. It's like, we want Xbox everywhere, and if you want Xbox everywhere, you have to... And they have been doing this. They have been porting their games over to other consoles, to other platforms. And I think, you know, the fact that, you know, there have been reports that they canceled the first party Xbox handheld and they were relying more on Asus as a partnership, that kind of, to me, signals where, you know, Xbox is at when, in terms of, we're not at a point where they want to fully invest in making their own first party gaming hardware, portable gaming hardware right now. And they're going to take the sort of easier way out by, you know, we're going to do a collab and a partnership, and then we're going to put our stamp on it for sure, but it's not going to be a fully wholly owned Xbox product.
The report I saw, by the way, was that they were more like pausing work on whatever their handheld would be to kind of do this first. And that probably makes some more sense because Asus has already been building the stuff. They've already been building the ROGs. They have a good sense of hardware. Asus is an OEM for a lot of companies too, like in terms of making hardware. So yeah, get that out quickly. That doesn't mean they're not going to do their own handheld. And
for sure. But if Microsoft was really confident about it, they would have been like, okay, we're full steam ahead with this first party handheld. And for them to pause it and redo the collab thing first, is a good indicator of what we might see going forward.
I don't think they're confident about anything in gaming. Like, this is kind of why I want to have this conversation, because I think Microsoft is just like looking at everything being like, oh my God, tariffs, bad. Our sales figures, bad. Developers not making exclusive games for Xbox, bad. Sony is getting everything. And now they're like, handheld? Yes, that can happen eventually. But this, the Xbox division has been losing money, has been losing billions of dollars for many, many years. Whereas the rest of Microsoft is like, yay AI, yay cloud, our revenues are through the roof, right?
Okay, yeah. So Devinder, you're going in the direction that I was about to go in. Like, after having just finished Empire of AI, I'm like, wow, they are throwing so much money at OpenAI. They are maybe the biggest minority partner. Don't quote me on that, but they have thrown a ton of support toward OpenAI, and like their cloud services are also really supporting OpenAI. And it seems really weird now that they splashed so much cash on this Activision deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's possible that they could be working toward a play where they bring these two things together and they're like, okay, well, now we're going to generate like unique dialogue from these characters using OpenAI's LLM or something, and also use it to generate the voices. The video game voice actors are not going to be happy about that. They'll definitely have something to say about that. But right now, I don't see a clear path for them to bring those together in a not ham-handed way. Maybe focusing on being a publisher, at least for a while, is the best thing.
That'll at least make them money, right? Selling games, especially to other companies, will make money. This, especially with the franchises they have. I will say this, though. The reason why Microsoft will not just be another Sega is that all Sega had was games. That's all they had. If you weren't making it in the game market as Sega in the late 90s, you're done. There's nothing else you can do. Microsoft has a ton of things, and Microsoft has AI, it has the cloud, it has things that are making money and literally printing money for them, which is why I feel like they can kind of hold it out a bit. Certainly, I feel like for maybe the people at Xbox, that Activision deal was like the last straw. That was your last gasp to do something big and meaningful. It's just taken a long time to get a result from that. It's going to take like 10 years for them to see the full like power of that potential acquisition. It kind of makes sense for Microsoft to have just a really good Switch-like handheld that can both be docked to a TV to be like an Xbox Series S level thing, like a low-level gaming thing, but also you have a really great cloud streaming platform, and if you want to play higher quality graphics, you can technically do that over the cloud too, as we've seen with GeForce Now. I also kind of think like once things have settled, once the hardware world is less crazy, we had that idea, just make a big ass Xbox. Just make a big ass powerful Xbox. And that's basically what the PlayStation 5 Pro is. The Series X 2 terabyte is now $800. I don't think they will be rushing to lower those prices anytime soon. So if they were like, hey, our new great high-end system, we've heard all the feedback or whatever, for the true gamers, that one is $800. Here is a $400, $500 handheld that'll get you most of the way there, and you can dock it like a Switch. Like, I can see them kind of diversifying in that way. But as we were saying before, just make it a freaking Windows box, man. Just open it up. Yeah.
I wrote a story like 8 years ago. It's like, I still think Microsoft could do a really good Microsoft could do a really good Xbox gaming laptop. I'm not sure. That seems like it would have been such a slam dunk if they just, you know, nailed the specs. But I'm not calling shots.
It could have been good, except they were also burning billions on laptops there too, like trying to make the Surface.
For sure.
Thing
but
too.
The interesting thing is that like now, if you look at a lot of like new Surface laptops, a lot of them have ARM based chips.
Yeah.
Does this, you know, is there, this is like a really shot in the dark sort of situation, but like, is there a situation where, hey, maybe Microsoft works on a first party gaming handheld, but it's an ARM based gaming handheld, which would be closer to the Switch too, than like, you know, traditional x86 based PC portable. I think that's an interesting possibility we could, you know, might happen.
Especially with ARM Windows, like Windows on ARM being a thing, like certainly gaming is more possible on those things. That's certainly a thing I could see them doing.
And it would lower the price, and it would make it a lot more, it would be positioned more as a streaming thing that could play local, some local games. And that would seem to fit a little bit more in Microsoft's gaming strategy. But like I said, things are very up in the air, so it's really hard to say for sure what's going to happen.
If Microsoft could make like a $300 handheld that's like, hey, you can play some games here, but also tap into the cloud and you get much higher quality graphics and stuff, but it's cheaper than the Switch, like, then you start to have options. But these, like, they're not aggressive in that way, and they're not willing to waste more money, I think. So we will see. We will see how all this is going.
So one more thing before we move on to talking about like good games that came out recently. There was a question from Wes Jackson in the chat who asked, who do you guys think will come out on top in terms of handheld gaming OS, Steam OS or Windows and Xbox? My thinking is that it's going to break down into a Windows Apple situation where pretty much everything is going to be on the Windows and Xbox platform. And then you're going to get like a few really, really well thought out bangers coming out on SteamOS, and there are going to be fanboys on each side.
That's certainly possible. I still think we are a long time away where like there's an SteamOS exclusive that only runs on Linux. That seems
it's
like
a very different thing.
A very big bridge that we have not gotten to
yet. The thing is, Windows runs Steam. It runs all of Steam. It runs all of those games. So if you have a Windows device, you have a Steam device. You know, like, so SteamOS was a great stopgap, I think, by Valve, because Microsoft was just sitting there being lost in the weeds, like not knowing what to do about handhelds, not knowing what to do about so many things, as we've seen.
And there are rumors that Valve is working on like a PC-based SteamOS device, which brings back all those, remember, all the difficulties with Steam machines back in like the mid-2010s. But so, you know, that is kind of coming full cycle. And it's really interesting to see is like, you know, Valve has been beating this Linux gaming drum with SteamOS and Steam machines for way more than a decade. So it's, I think it's really encouraging actually to see this, like Valve is more committed to this platform and to the thing. And when you have a company that, you know, doesn't waver or, you know, is not, you know, very, seems to be a lot more confident in something like that, how, you know, if you keep at it, you can eventually, you know, build something up that becomes a lot very attractive, which is what we're having in
It helps when you have a singular focus, right? Valve is like, they get up in the morning, they're like, games, games, games. All I want is games. All I want is people, also subscription revenue from various services, but games. And Microsoft is like such a confused company right now. Like they're snorting AI. And I feel like that's all that's gotten straight into their brains, and they're like throwing money at that stuff. But so are all the other big companies. But Microsoft has Office stuff.
They take
stuff.
A big rip of AI, and they're like, "We should open a restaurant. We should open a bar. We're gonna make so much money.
We're gonna make so much money. Let's invest in this. Let's invest in that." But Microsoft has Office and Windows and server stuff, and you know, stuff that is sold to governments, government contracts. That's fun. Microsoft has its hand in so many pies that they lack that focus. But ultimately, if they can make a Windows install that's pretty decent on portable systems, like, that's going to be the biggest one. But SteamOS is here now, and it's been a great success for Steam for years. So that's kind of the benefit there, right? They singularly focused on making a portable system that is really good at games. We'll be talking more about like the state of Xbox and the state of gaming eventually, folks. Let's move on to some of our favorite games that we're playing right now. What is really, you know, taking up your time?
It's crazy. There are so many good games coming out this fall. You know, I think you're playing Silksong too, but the game that I just came out, I'm want to dive into more is Final Fantasy Tactics, the Evolus Chronicles. This game is like, and we were talking about this in Slack the other day. I didn't realize until, you know, somewhat recently that they didn't have the source code for this game. And so, because I guess the practice back in the day was you would just overwrite for every new version and you just keep it going and going and going. But when you want to do like a proper, you know, remaster, remake sort of situation, you kind of need that source code and a lot of the original master data. And they didn't have that. So they kind of had to make the game from scratch. And this is just like, this is such a love letter to one of my all-time favorite games. And there are some like, there's like a small camp of people who are just like really upset that they didn't include the War of the Lions content from the PSP version of the game.
Yeah.
And I get it because I would have loved to have Dark Knight, I think Onion Knight and Dark Knight in the game. I don't really care as much about some of the guest characters. Like they had Balthier because Final Fantasy XII had come around the same time. They're kind of doing, you know, cross game promotion and stuff like that. I don't care as much about that. But, you know, if you look at what you're getting fully voice acting, and they had to rewrite some of the script because some of the stuff that doesn't fully translate when a game goes from text only to voice acting. It is just like it is so nice to have, and it's like a wonderful just like reinterpretation of an already great game that I just do not have enough time in my life to sink as many hours into this game as I want to.
What platform do you put it on, Sam? Because I have it on Switch too. I'm like, my God, is that perfect? It's perfect to be on the Switch.
I'm playing it on Switch 2 for the exact same reason. It is such a great portable game that, like, and it's like, oh, if you're playing on the couch, you can play a level, save, put it down, and then pick it up back up. It's such a good, like, chapter episodic game that, like, being available in a portable way, and it's been available on iOS and Android for many, many years, but the extra quality, and you have the two different versions where you have the classic version and the new remastered graphics and stuff like that. It's just so nice.
It's just did you play the original when it came out in 97, Sam?
Yes, I actually, well, not 97. I think I played it on a little bit later on PlayStation, I think. But and then I played it again when it came out on iOS in like the mid-2000s, I think it was. And I just, this is a game that like I'm like happy to replay like every 5 years because it's that good.
It's that good. Like, I'm also playing it, and I have such a deep love for this game. Let me tell you, I spent hundreds of hours on the original Final Fantasy Tactics in, like, 97. It's also why, like, how did I even get that game? Because, right, I was a teenager, was not really into, like, tactical strategy RPGs. But I think it was, I was a fan of Final Fantasy VII. Hey, look, a new Final Fantasy game. And it was, like, $40, which was a steal back then. So I remember going to, like, Circuit City or something to pick this up, thinking I got a really good deal. And being, like, kind of shocked by what it is, because it's not a normal RPG. It is a game where everybody's on a tile board, you move people around, you attack very methodically and very carefully, but I got really into the vibe. And the other thing is that Final Fantasy Tactics was also a really well-written game about class struggle and the differences between the rich and the poor, and also the way the wealthy class and the ruling class can really screw over people who are beneath them. And the director for this game, the original writer, like, put out a great statement ahead of this re-release saying, like, you know, the original game was written as Japan was dealing with an economic downturn and things didn't look so great for them as a country. And now he's like, that wealth inequality is still here. In fact, it's even bigger now. And it is a perfect time to revisit the themes and everything of this game. So
it's such a timeless story that like you it's one of those things is like, even if you know what happens, you go back and you find like new little tidbits. It's like, oh man, I really appreciate this one line that like I didn't notice before.
It is. And it's funny because like with the voice acting, this game feels like, oh, this is Game of Thrones now, right? Like I used to was reading it all in my head and making up stuff and making up like what these names sounded like. But no, now they are professionally voice acted in ways with, I think, really well done. Like there's a lot of drama in how these characters talk and how well their how great their performances are. Like it really just adds a lot to the game, but also it's just so addictive. It's just like the sort of like job system you have in this game where you start out as a squire, you could become like a chemist or something else. But as you get more experience, you can expand your jobs. You could become an archer. You could become a thief. You could become a ninja. You could become a samurai. And all those skills kind of build on each other. Within like 1 hour, Sam, I was already finding myself JP farming once again. I was like, oh, I'm in this battle.
You got to raise the class level so you can unlock new classes. And this is like core of is like, oh, you want to plan out your builds and plan out like, oh, I need to get this person to like Black Mage level 4 so I can unlock this. And it's like, I want to have my squad of like balanced like magic and physical attack. Oh, it's great.
It's also good.
Like, it's such a great game to just like sit back and theory craft in a way that's fun, but like then you also have the story that brings you back to the actual plot. Yeah, absolutely.
Also want to shout out, I think the new graphics look good. Like you cannot really tell that they lost like the early batch of this game. That was the thing in the 90s for Japanese studios, but also like everybody, like they just did not save source code because they were like, what am I going to do with this? What do I need this for in 10 years? You know? So a lot of companies have just had bad backup practices. I'm so happy that this thing exists. I hope it's a success. I hope like it's a thing that convinces them to make more tactic games in this vein, because they did follow up the series with the Final Fantasy Tactics Advance games for Game Boy Advance. They're just not the same. They're not.
They're good, but they're not the same.
Yeah,
I agree.
They're not the same. They're like about kids and like a dream world and all this stuff, and it lost the like great storyline, great characters of this one. I've always loved. I wish we could see a version of this game from Delita's point of view. The game is about Ramza Beowulf, a young noble boy. He's raised in a rich family, finds out that the world is more complex than he thinks. But his best friend is a commoner who's brought into his family. and ends up being this person who is like, I am so fed up with the ruling class. Like, I am going to go out on my own, like, start some shit. And Delita's out there, like, kidnapping princesses and doing stuff, but also at the same time being somebody who's like, has a good heart, right? Is trying to change things for the better. And that character is fascinating. I hope, like, we'd eventually get to play him. But anyway, Final Fantasy Tactics, The Evilise Chronicles, it's out now on all systems. Also funny, on the Switch, like, you can buy it both for Switch 1 and Switch 2 because it doesn't need Switch 2 power. But it's kind of cool that these things can just be broadly available in these platforms. Ben, I think you would appreciate this game, even if you're not, like, big into these sorts of, like, tactical RPGs. It's so
I
good.
Mean, I like tactics. It's yeah. just that I've never been a Final Fantasy guy.
Doesn't matter. Like, it's so un-Final Fantasy. Yeah.
The game that was put into my hand at, like, a very impressionable age was a friend of mine from down the hall in my apartment building was like, this game is too hard for me. Do you want it? And it was Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. And that was what set me down the road of, wow, games can be art. They're like, this is an amazing story. We have another couple of games that we want to mention. Ghost of Yotei, out now, today. It's going to be great. We don't have anything to say about it yet because I don't think anybody else has
touched it. I've heard good things, but yeah, yeah.
How do we feel about Silksong and Hades 2?
I think everybody loves that. I haven't heard a single bad thing about Silksong, really.
Yeah, yeah. Other than
that it's hard.
Very, very
and
hard.
Like, I've never been a platformers guy. That's another thing that makes me unpopular among gamers.
This is
I mean, but coming from anyone who has aware of Hollow Knight, they knew Silksong was not going to be easy. You know, it's always been the, like, hey, the Hollow Knight and Silksong are like the 2D version of Dark Souls, and it's like, you know what you're getting.
You know what you're getting.
Yeah.
I talked about initially when it came out. I thought, like, certain elements, like, I think the diagonal jump, the diagonal down attack move is really tough because you're supposed to, like, bounce off of that onto many other platforms. And the game is very punishing, and after a certain point, the developers start to just, like, make fun of you. Like, literally, they will set up a safe thing, and they're like, yeah, come here, relax a bit, and it will be a thing that kills you. And you can imagine the developers being like, got him.
I've seen people say online that the original Hollow Knight is the tutorial for Silksong.
Yeah, basically, because Hollow Knight, you start out with worse skills, a harder to control character, and also everybody hits you for double damage. So it is a punishing game. But Ben, platformers are great. Like, I think for me, I'm the direct opposite. Like, I was born and shaped by platformers, right? By Super Mario Brothers 1, by all the NES platformers, Metroidvanias, Symphony of the Night.
That's the big difference in, like, our generational displacement. I started coming in to gaming when you first started having, like, third person over the shoulder.
It was certainly a big shift, but there were platformers. You had Mario 64. That was platforming, although not as good.
True.
3D platforming was
That was a 3D, like, third person platformer too.
Yeah, I've always just loved the sort of crispness and the sort of, like, exacting nature of a 2D platformer. And what I love is the fact that indie games have just kept that alive. Like, the love for sprites, the love for old school platforming feels like, oh, everything I did love early on, I knew that was good for a reason, you know, and certainly Metroidvanias. Silksong is great. I love spending time in it. It is frustrating at times, but also it is rewarding in a way to me that the Dark Souls games aren't, because Dark Souls, you can always go somewhere and, like, level up and, like, really beat up a boss after that. Silksong is like, no, this is training. You are training the patterns. You are learning the movements. You are learning how to become a better player too. So, like, some bosses have taken me like 20, 30 times to get through. But by the time I'm there at the end, I'm like slicing and dicing. I'm just, like, so in the zone of, like, what this boss is going to do. You're, like, thinking ahead and outsmarting them. And to me, that just feels genuinely rewarding in a way that few things do in games these days. So that's what I love about Silksong. But what about you, Sam? How are you feeling it?
I have not had a chance to dive into Silksong as much. And then there's another game, Hades 2, yes. which is like...
The big theme here, I think, is two small development teams that learned a lot making the first game, and then they brought all of that stuff that they wanted to talk about after they finished the first game into the second game. Like, Silksong wasn't even supposed to be its own standalone game.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be DLC, and then they just feature crept it into its own game. I don't really expect Team Cherry or Supergiant to do a Hollow Knight 3 or Hades 3, just because they might be taking the same approach as Valve, which is the first game is fun because you're doing something new. The second game is where you get to apply everything that you learned making the first game. And then the third game, if you have it, is really just a quest for more money.
Yeah, and definitely, especially I think Supergiant, even more more than the other developer, is like, if you look at their catalog of games, Bastion, Transistor, Pyre, mm-hmm. before they got to Hades, they are such a good developer because they make the games that they want to play. And you know that, like, when they're making these games, you can see the lineage of, oh, these are the games that they played when they were kids, and that is what is informing and inspiring the work that they're doing on their current products or current work. And it's just like, it's one of those things where you can tell, it's like, it's stupid classic line is like, this is games by for gamers by gamers, and like you can really get a sense of that when you play their games.
Mm-hmm. So I played Hades 1 quite a bit. I did Hades 2 in early access like months ago. Sam, has much changed with version 1?
And so this is my like big sadness about this year. There's so much going on. I haven't had Hades 2 is the one that I'm gonna have to like,
because Sam has a new baby.
Well, there's
although
that.
I watched my partner play a run of Hades 2 just a couple days ago, and I also watched them play it in early access. There's not a lot that has changed between early access and now.
Yeah, they knew what they were
That's
doing.
That's another check mark in the list of like, you guys learned a lot making this first Hades game. So even the early access version of Hades 2 is going to be way better than early access original Hades.
And I think a lot of it is like optimization and tweaks that just make the game just run better, play better. And yeah,
they did add some story stuff. I'm not That's going good. To mention it as a spoiler or anything, but you see some old friends.
That's good.
A lot of the gods are coming back, but there are some other old friends too.
I mean, yeah, Hades 1 was like, what I noticed from the early access is Hades 2, like, they've just perfected the action. They perfected the combat and movement and all these skills, and the different weapons feel so good too. So it's just so satisfying. Again, 2D, like 2D action, the sort of like preciseness you can get with that. Also makes me want to go back and finish Transistor, because it's a game I love the vibe and style of it. I never quite finished it. That was also like a weird hybrid of like side scroller, but also tactics, because like there were some like tactical elements of that too. Good stuff. What a time. What a time right now. I want to spend some time with Ghosts of Yote. Also that Mario Galaxy and Galaxy 2 remake at some point. But really, these days, like I can pick a handful of games that I spend some time on. And right now that's been Silksong, when I can carve out some time, and also Final Fantasy Tactics. And what is cool is that I can now play alongside my daughter, who's playing Minecraft, and now we can game together side by side. So I'm loving that time. It'll be there for you too eventually, Sam. You just got to stick with it.
Yes. And I was going to say, that's one of the reasons I'm excited for the Mario Galaxy Galaxy 2 releases, because those games are actually hard to get on Switch, because it was only available in like a limited time collection package. And so now, hey, I got to play a demo of those games, and it's like Mario Galaxy 1 is like, oh man, I forgot how good this game is. Mario Galaxy 2 is a little bit weird because of the Yoshi aiming and star shooting mechanic, which feels a tiny bit rough compared to like the modern implementation with like motion controls works and stuff like that. But they're both excellent games, and just to be able to have them on a modern platform and a much more accessible way is very good.
Very good. All right, folks. We'll be back with game stuff too. I want to get Jess Conda on here, but she's not feeling well right now, and I want to get her thoughts as our gaming journalist about like how things are going. So we'll do another check-in with games soon. Stay tuned. Let's move on to other news that's happening this week. And I think the big one, the one that we were all preparing for, was the new Amazon event, the Amazon Fall Device Advance. Sam, you were there with Sherlyn and Jeff, right, from Engadget, Def Done. And right. It's everything expected, right? You've got we've got some new Echoes. We have an Echo Dot Max, a bigger Echo Dot. Echo Studio that is now orb-shaped like the others and not cylindrical. They're announced a home theater mode with the Echoes, which Jeff tried out and I think is kind of weird because the home theater mode is like, hey, do you have five of these expensive speakers? You have five Echo Dot Maxes, which is the cheapest entry point into this feature. You could spread around your living room. It'll work with surround sound, they say, automatically with the new Fire TV sticks, or at least the more powerful ones. You don't have a subwoofer. These are not big speakers. You're not going to get great surround sound. That's $500 at a minimum. Go get a soundbar, folks. Go get a soundbar. Look at our, we have a great soundbar guide. Get us the Sonos Beam 2 is under $500, I think, at this point. It's great. It's great. You don't need the rear speakers even. Like the virtualized surround sound will be great. There's an Echo, new Echo Show 8 and Echo Show 11. Kindle Scribe Color Soft, which is they basically smushed together the Kindle Scribe and the Color E-Ink Color Soft. This thing is $630.
I know the price. The price is really high, but it looks so good.
It looks cool.
For me, I've wanted a good Color E-Ink something device. And it feels like it's been taking forever to get there. But the Kindle Scribe Color Soft, when you just look at it in person, it's like, oh, this is so nice. And it almost makes me wonder, like, how would modern technology be different if we had really good color e-ink displays 10 years ago?
It would be much slower. We would be all still waiting for the refresh rates for those e-ink displays, Sam. But maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we're consuming information too quickly. Maybe we got to take a step back and go at e-ink speeds. It's a cool idea. Not at this price. And also, there's a new Kindle Scribe that's refreshed. Starts at $500 or $430 without the front light. But you would not want these things without the front light.
Yeah, I would say probably don't get it without the front light. But
so $500 for the new Kindle Scribe. Again, too much. Fire TV, they have refreshed TVs. There's a Fire TV Stick 4K Select for $40. New Blink cameras, a new Ring camera. A new Ring doorbell as well. And all these things are really tied together with Alexa Plus, which is their premium offering for like AI powered Alexa stuff. I believe it's $20 a month. I'm not super excited. Like, I like having Echo Dots around and having Echo devices around to talk to, mainly to like control stuff in my house. I don't know if I need like them to be super AI powered things, because I'd rather do that on my phone. Sam, how do you feel about Alexa Plus at this point?
Personally, I have Google devices in my household. And so, yes, there was also some Google smart home news. We'll get to that in a little bit. Like you said, I really like having smart speakers because it makes smart home automation a lot more accessible.
Yes.
Because there's so many times like, just go turn off the lights or go turn off the music or all of that. And like, it's kind of nice to be able to just interact with something without needing a screen. And that is something that I really like. And I think, like you said before, this really does tie into the Alexa Plusness of it all, where they're, you know, Amazon is trying to make sure that, hey, it's easier to make automations with your voice. That was a big thing that they talked about in the thing in the presentation of like, hey, you can just make routines just by using your voice. You don't have to go in there and mess around with if this, then that protocols and stuff like that.
That's cool.
And it's like, you know, it's removing the need for like a dedicated smart home hub because, hey, your smart speaker is, or in this case, the smart display. There are new Echo Show 8 and Echo Show 11s. So, you know, there is a huge range of new kind of smart home products to talk about. And they're all, I think the designs are much nicer. They're, you know, they're more modern and more refined. If you go look at the old Echo Show 8, it's just like a wedge. It's like not very attractive. And so I think those needed a definite, visual hardware update for quite a
while. I'm intrigued like to get some sort of like smart display thing in my kitchen, because I feel like that would be it would be useful there as a speaker. Right now I have like an Echo Studio, like just sitting near.
Just having one as like a photo frame that does extra stuff is actually at the barest like functional level is just really nice to have.
And also you could throw video to it when you want to, like when you're watching something. So yeah, I get that. I kind of maybe will do that. So we'll see. I'm also thinking about that and the Google devices. One thing I want to point out, the new Ring cameras have they also have new AI features. Retinal vision is a thing they're talking about where it'll, they just do more with the sensors to determine like make clearer videos and things like that. They announced a feature called Search Party, which freaked me the hell out because search party is a thing they say right now. It's for helping people to find lost dogs. When a neighbor reports a missing dog on the Ring app, search party commences on nearby Ring cameras. So other cameras around your neighborhood. These will start to look out and notify camera owners if they spot what seems to be a missing dog. The camera owner will then see a photo of the pet alongside relevant camera footage and can choose whether to alert the dog's owner. Search party will roll out in November. That's according to our write-up by Chris Holt here for our whole roundup of all this stuff.
The press release says, you can find a lost dog.
Yeah.
What I hear is when local law enforcement wants to find someone, then they'll be able to do it really easily.
When when ICE wants to hunt somebody down, which is what is happening on our streets right now, yay, network cameras.
Yeah, that's built the awkward part of the whole kind of surveillance, modern surveillance ecosystem. And Ring has historically been one of the most proactive in terms of working with local law enforcement. And if you're the kind of person who doesn't necessarily think that's a great thing, that is definitely not going to change your opinion about the new Amazon devices, because they're launching even diving even harder into that.
They're basically like handing cops like this tool on a silver platter that can be used in very bad ways down the line. Like once it's not a dog, think about what it could be profiling. Think about how it could be working and how the thing in your home could be a part of that. I have a doorbell camera. I think it's very useful. I have an Arlo one. It does not tie into anything else. It's just like, hey, you got a package. Cool. That's all. And that's kind of how I use Alexa too. It's like, hey, turn off the lights. Don't talk to me anymore. Because sometimes it goes, it's like, hey, would you like this new product that just came out? You seem like you're in the market for this. Sometimes Amazon goes too far and you got to rein these things in. Anything else you want to mention from the Amazon event, Sam? Because you were there in person. Like Panos Panay, the new head of Amazon devices, was there. It is always funny to hear. They did not live stream this event, but we heard this event thanks to our own little live stream. But when Panos talks about his devices, this guy sounds like a preacher. He sounds like he is just delivering a sermon about how our devices can make our lives better and connect us to each other. How's Panos doing, Sam? How is he actually
excited?
I mean,
he seems to be having a great time. Yeah. I have heard through the grapevine that Panos is a big Diet Coke fan, which, okay, that's cool.
Relatable.
I'm more of a Coke Zero guy, but I get it.
Yeah.
So it's like that transition when he talks about, like, you know, he had a kind of a monologue about talking about how when everyone's sitting around the dinner table and then suddenly you pull out a phone, you've lost the moment. And he's totally right. And then, but you know, the next transition was, instead of pulling out your phone where you kind of lost the moment, you have one person looking down and maybe other people are continuing the conversation, he goes, you can bring an AI assistant into the conversation, and they can, because they have a voice and you're not looking at a screen, it feels a little bit more natural. And I'm like,
now we're talking to a speaker.
I don't know if we're quite there yet.
Yeah.
And this is like,
also, like, I know Panos has kids who are, I think, in high school now. Like, he talked about his kids, like, rowing crew or something in a recent event, like last year or so. Once you start talking to Alexa, that opens the floodgates for the kids to be like, Alexa, play 10 fart sounds.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, that's losing the moment also.
It's right. You got to wait till your kids are mature to have a conversation with a nearby AI assistant. All these things. It's funny that all these companies are like, they spent the past 10, 20 years delivering devices to steal our attention away. And now they're like, some devices can be bad. Okay. So maybe we should focus more on each other with a new device over here. An AI.
And the thing is, like, there are some advancements, and some of these are AI like powered features, where, you know, they are doing summaries of your video camera feed. So, hey, it's like someone came and delivered a package. Instead of saying someone has arrived at the front door, you know, the AI is processing and goes, oh, hey, you got a package delivery. And if you're looking through your, like, activity feed or your, you know, your notification feed from your smart home devices, that's a genuinely useful thing. It's like, I was expecting a package. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that the thing can tell me that's what actually happened. But, you know, you go back to, you know, the kind of surveillance ecosystem and mass surveillance. And it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, it's one of those classic double-edged knives or double-edged swords where it's like, there are definite positives that we're getting with this, and there are things that we need to continue to be aware of. We can continue to monitor how they affect, you know, what devices go into our lives and into our homes. So yeah, it's one of those things. Like, I like the idea, but there are concerns.
For sure. And also, you mentioned, Sam, but Google has some new stuff too. New Nest doorbell, new Nest cameras. I think a speaker that's coming next year for some reason.
Yes.
Or something.
And so this is, unsurprisingly, this happened the day after the Amazon event. And this is like kind of, maybe, I don't know if Google's being petty or what, or they're trying to steal some thunder. But like, they came out with a whole new line of Nest indoor camera, outdoor camera, doorbell. And this is also coming with a brand new kind of UI for Google Home. And I think it's going to be a lot easier because, once again, they're using AI to kind of condense those traditional notifications, which, you know, if you had, you know, a plan where that would, you know, see all of the things that are going on inside your house, you would get completely overloaded with notifications. And now it's doing AI-generated summaries. And actually, that is definitely useful because, hey, I'm getting an overview of what's happening. I'm not getting 200 notifications that are just blowing up my notification tray. And then that is also coming with now Gemini, and we've seen this transition coming for a long time, but now Gemini is replacing the Google Assistant as your AI assistant on Google Home devices. And this is good. Gemini is smarter and better. And it was really awkward when Gemini was like the main AI assistant on mobile devices and phones and stuff like that. And then you had Google Assistant on the smart home devices. That was a really awkward thing. So it's really good to have that transition kind of in full force now. And the new devices, they look good. There's a new Google Home speaker. It's going to be available in this like berry color, which I think is really eye-catching. And there's also a jade one. Haven't heard what it sounds like really to kind of say that. But unsurprisingly, they are also coming out with a feature that new Google Home speaker, when paired with a Google TV streamer, can also serve as like your audio source when you're watching TV. And so obviously there's like a very big competition between Amazon and Google specifically when it comes to building out their smart home ecosystems. And I don't think that either company has a specific feature or feature set that I'd be like, oh, I'm going to get rid of all my Alexa devices and I'm now going to go do Google Home or vice versa. But it is nice to see that they're kind of advancing this in a way that they understand that. And Google is also doing the like, hey, you want to set up automations with your voice. You don't want to program it yourself. You can do that. And there's a new automations tab where you can see things and adjust them. And so it is nice to see this kind of advancement of, we want the smart home to be easier and more accessible to use. And I definitely think they are achieving that on a very tangible way. You know, you still have to ask yourself the question of, do I need all these devices? Do I need all these cameras on my house? That is a fair question that I think everyone has to answer for themselves.
And you also have to pay more for the Gemini capabilities, right? Like, you will, the whole point of these things is like, hey, these devices are great. You pay us 10, 20 bucks a month, and then they'll be even better with AI smarts. And is that recurring revenue they really, really want? So
for sure.
This is what that.
Although in my specific case, I am actually getting some new features because I'm already on the Google One AI plan. It's the bigger storage plan is the reason I got it, but it does come with, it feels like Google has been adding more stuff to that bucket. So I feel like I'm getting more out of it. I wasn't going to change my plan anyways, but like, I'm probably less likely to downgrade to the lower storage one because now I have a few extra features than I did before.
Gotcha. I want to quickly say, I think the design of these new cameras is nice because like the theme this year is just circles. It's just circles. They're nice, nice round circles. Circle camera, circle doorbell. Looks very clean, which is unlike a lot of things from Nest from back of the day. Maybe the thermostat.
And one of the reasons I think I had a chance to talk to some of the people on the Google Home Nest team, and they said that the speaker is coming out in 2026 specifically because they wanted to make sure that it could do all the things that it needed to be a valued member of, you know, the Nest ecosystem. And so they're giving it a little bit more leeway. And in some respects, I appreciate that instead of like, hey, we're going to come out with this thing. It's not going to be out till next year. If you want to wait for it, at least you know what we're doing. And so no one's going to be surprised like, oh, I just bought a new Google Home speaker and now this new thing get announced and I'm sad.
Take that, Amazon, basically. Okay, we've got a couple other stories, but we're also getting pretty long this week. So I think we're going to I'm going to briefly mention, hey, OpenAI announced their new Sora 2 video generation model. There's a new Sora social video app, which is making like cameo style clips. I'm still left thinking, what the hell do we do with these things? We're going to have a longer discussion about these topics in the coming week. And also, we really want to talk about Tilly Norwood, which is that AI actress thing. hey, this marketing studio is trying to make an AI actress. Her name is Tilly Norwood. There's a short out there called AI Commissioner where they're trying to hype it up, which is also entirely made in AI. It all sucks. It all absolutely sucks. So it is funny to see the entire industry, like pretty much the entertainment industry, has been like, no, thank you to all of this. Like, they are just saying no to it.
In fact, Emily Blunt said in a podcast recording with Variety, good Lord, we're screwed. That's really, really scary. Come on, agencies, don't do that. Please stop. Please stop taking away our human connection.
That's pretty much it. And also, I think a lot of creatives are like no to this. There's this AI Commissioner is a short which is trying to sell Tilly Norwood, but it's also entirely AI made, featuring AI actors. They look kind of real. They look pretty photorealistic now. But the thing I keep noticing is, why are your teeth out of focus? Why? Things are just weird. It's like an alien trying to. Teeth. Yeah, a little.
Also, their motion is still way too smooth.
It's gross. We're gonna talk more about all this stuff at some point down the line, of course.
One thing from the Sora AI video situation is that the things that are popular on this Sora app, you cannot get the app right now unless you get an invite. But I imagine
you can buy them on eBay.
General public is going to be able to see it soon.
They're everywhere. Yeah.
One of the most popular videos was created by someone who's like, let's make like a security camera footage sort of thing of Sam Altman stealing GPUs from an electronics store to make OpenAI even better, or like to run Sora on a local instance. And then more and more people are making these videos of various people and characters, including Pokemon, shoplifting. This can't possibly be used to push horrifically racist political narratives. Like, no, not at all.
Not at all.
That's not going to happen.
Just like Search Party. These companies.
I mean, sometimes when you come out with disruptive tech, it actually is really fucking disruptive.
Yes, disruptive to society. Yeah. It's supposed to be disruptive to businesses.
Unfortunately, they forgot about that last part.
Yeah. So many things. Anyway, this is a bigger topic we'll have to spend some time on. Real quick, just want to check out Carissa Bell's review of the Ray-Ban Meta 2 smart glasses. She says they're finally getting useful. The more I think and write about like what Meta and all these smart glasses companies are doing, the worse I feel. Like, just like as we're talking about.
I was going to say, in addition to having a gaming focus podcast, we're going to have a smart glass focus podcast at some point.
Oh, absolutely. What I'm working on a review of the 2026 Nissan Leaf, which I love. So stay tuned for that.
So glad that you were checking this thing out.
It's because so good. Yeah.
I also feel like the Nissan Ariya kind of got like a short shift.
It did.
And it incorporates a lot of the things that I liked about the Ariya, but in an even more affordable package. And it's feels like it's kind of staying true to that like Leaf ethos, but yes, I'm sure you'll cover that in your review.
It's great. My kids love it. Like, what they were managed to do at a lower price point is pretty fantastic. So yeah, I wish I could buy the new Nissan Leaf, maybe eventually, maybe in a couple of years. Sam, anything you want to shout out that you're working on?
I'm working on a couple embargo device reviews. I can't really talk about them yet.
You had to silence one of them, right?
Yes, I had before the podcast, make sure it wasn't making any noise and gave myself away. But I did also have the Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop review just go up. So if you were in the market for a big flagship, this is like your classic like desktop replacement gaming laptop. It is also kind of pricey. It does start at $2,000, although the one I've reviewed was closer to like $2,600. But it, you know, it's got big performance, and I actually really like the new design. It's like kind of splits the difference between something that's like a little bit more understated and Alienware's classic like galactic spaceship themed kind of visual ID.
Awesome.
So if you're interested in a gaming laptop, go read that.
in terms of pop culture picks, real quick, I just want to say, hey, check out The Lowdown on Hulu/FX/Disney Plus now, I guess. But yeah, it's Ethan Hawke is a citizen journalist. He calls himself a true historian. It is such a perfect little show for our time right now. It is very much about a guy fighting for truth in like an insane world versus the rich and the powerful. Alien Earth had its season one finale, and oh boy, was that a Noah Hawley season one finale. So I love the early episodes. I did not like the way that season went down. And be sure to check out One Battle After Another in theaters too, at the biggest screen you can find, because that movie is real good. Sam, anything else you want to shout out?
Yeah, I just finished Silo season two, which it ends on a real cliffhanger, and I'm a little annoyed about that, but I had a really good time. I think they took a little bit too long to get to the finale. But aside from that, I love a good post-apocalyptic TV show or book in this case, which is both. Go check it out. And I'm probably going to pick up Foundation Season 3 next, because I need to get back to that.
I've heard that Foundation gets really good, and I just have not had time for it. But man, from what I saw Season 1, that show looks so good. Like, it's so expensive. They put so much money into it.
That's it for the episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. And the podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Sam online at...
at Sam Rutherford on Twitter and also Blue Sky. I posted like one more Blue Sky tweet, whatever, than I did in like the last month.
Congratulations.
I'm slowly working my way up to it.
You can find Devendra online at...
at Devendra on Blue Sky, and I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast, thefilmcast.com.
You can send me cool platformer games that I'll probably never play to Hey Bellman on Blue Sky. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That's RSS or Spotify.